Jim Gallison. I am a tech writer for a Silicon Valley company, and I have a kind of hobbyist interest in observing political systems and propaganda and anti-science.
This is the first episode of a series about fascism and science fiction. Meet Jim, a digital age prophet who cut his teeth on Kubrick's monoliths and Microsoft's code. Born at the crossroads of generations, raised on raw fuel of classic sci-fi, and forged in the fires of Silicon Valley's greatest empires, this is a man who watched 2001 A Space Odyssey three times before his fourth birthday. Not because his parents were film buffs, but because something in that cold, calculating vision of the future spoke to him. While other kids were playing with toys, Jim was already studying the dark arts of propaganda and advertising, developing the kind of bone-deep skepticism that would serve him well in an age of digital manipulation. His bloodline runs through the military-industrial complex itself. A father who guided space probes through the void at Goldstone and maintained the nuclear submarine simulators that could end civilization with the flip of a switch, Jim inherited that technical precision, that understanding of how power operates through systems and code. From MIT's halls to Boeing's assembly lines to Microsoft's digital empire, he's lived inside the machine, folks. He wrote that software, seeing the gears turn, watching as technology becomes a new frontier for authoritarian control. He spent decades in the belly of the beast, and now he's ready to tell you exactly what he saw there. In a world where fascism wears a friendly user interface and comes with terms and conditions, Jim is our guide through the intersection of science fiction, prophecy, and political nightmare. He's seen the future, and he's here to warn us. It's already arrived. Welcome, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lance. Thank you. That was more of an introduction than I could ever have imagined would apply to me, and in a factual way, even.
Right.
Thank you for that.
So, you know, we talked about this for a while, and so Jim and I know each other from working together in the belly of the beast, if you will, at Microsoft. We shared an office, and lots of conversations were had while we're working, and we got to know each other a little bit. And so I knew he would be a good guest for the show. He'd have like tons of material, probably more material than will fit in the show, but we're going to go for it anyhow. And Jim, you know, let's talk about fascism and science fiction.
Fascism and science fiction, yes. It's a rich mother lode that we can mine. It's been a topic of stories and films for decades, since arguably since even before the term fascism coined. You can look at like We by Yevgeny Zamyatin, and that was very much before Italian fascism appeared on the scene, but it's a recognizably fascist society that he conjured up, and both Aldous Huxley and George Orwell owe him a great debt of gratitude.
Yeah. I remember that. And I remember, so Yevgeny Zamyatin has the distinction of getting a letter from Stalin and not being immediately sent to a gulag. So yes. he thought he was screwed, and the letter showed up and people were thinking, oh yeah, this guy's a goner. But Stalin just banned him from all type of artwork that he could do in Russia. And so Yevgeny wrote him back a letter saying that he might as well go be killed, because as an artist, he's feeling he's now having the death of an artist. And that's the same thing to him.
What a story. Those are good times. Right. But that also leads us into discussing the differences between communism and fascism, right?
Right, right. Well, you do want to talk about, so you have this structure about, so there's this classification you came up with, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yes. Well, I don't take credit for it, but there has been a lot of thought around how to talk about fascism because, I mean, you know, you can be a punk kid on the streets in the UK in the 70s and you'd call everybody a fascist just because, you know, that's what you did.
Right.
But fascism is, it's both protean, it's always changing shape, but it has some characteristics that you can distill out of the various cases that we, historical cases that we have to look at. And so a few people have done that. I think most famously, the semiotician Umberto Eco famously wrote an essay in 1995 for the New York Times in which he identifies 14 characteristics of what he calls fascism or universal fascism. And I think those are a very useful framework to evaluate a society against.
What is a semiotician?
A semiotician who studies semiotics, basically symbols and language.
It's probably part of the root of semantics, I'm sort of guessing, but
Well, the sem part, I don't know. Yeah. We can look that up. We can use AI to tell us.
Cool. I don't mean to interrupt. So he wrote this, you were talking about these, 14 points of fascism.
Yes. Yes. The essay is titled Fascism, UR-Fascism. About a decade later, a political scientist, Dr. Lawrence Britt, wrote another essay identifying 14 characteristics. He must have been aware of the Eco essay, but he came up with a different list of 14 characteristics, which has some overlap, but also some interesting differences. I personally think Eco got more to the universal core than Britt did. I think Britt's is a little bit more contemporary and sort of seated in, I don't know, sort of Western society, modern Western society.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And part of the show on one of these episodes, we're going to talk about a fascism test, and we'll apply Eco's and Britt's model to some of the science fiction books we're going to talk about, and we're going to apply it to, well, our present day reality and see how we score up.
All right. That's an exciting project.
Now, before we go into that, I was wondering about the retrospective, contemporary, and speculative. Is that a good frame we should walk through?
Well, I was trying to think of a very lightweight framework that we could consider the vast body of science fiction literature that's been written about authoritarianism and totalitarianism and fascism and communism and societies in societal dysfunction generally. So it occurred to me that there's stories that are retrospective.
Jim, are you saying fascism is a dysfunction?
Well, to some people, it's a feature, not a bug.
Okay, just wondering.
I would consider it a dysfunction, but, you know, I'm a wild-haired Generation X / baby boomer. And which, interestingly, I found out recently that nexus, that very short period, the overlap between the boomers and Gen X is sometimes called Generation Jones. Which I thought was rather amusing. So you could say that I'm like quintessential Generation Jones. So, you know, if you think about science fiction stories as either retrospective treatments of fascism or contemporary treatments of fascism or speculative future treatments, they kind of fall neatly into those three buckets. So, for example, I think of Philip K. Dick's story, novel, The Man in the High Castle from 1962, which is a well-known alternate history story that imagines that the Axis powers won World War II and what happens in the United States, where the country is partitioned between the Nazi Germans who occupy the east part of the country and the Japanese Empire that occupies the west part of the country, and then the huge no man's land in the middle, which has just kind of renegade Americans living kind of Wild West. So I consider that very retrospective. It's like, well, this is what fascism was like. And remember all those years ago, you know, it was only 17 years after the end of World War II. So Philip K. Dick is reminding us like, oh, right. Yeah, that was terrible. There's a couple of old Star Trek episodes from original Star Trek that cover like World War II trauma, and another one named Patterns of Force. That's basically another reminder. Yeah. Remember what Nazism was like? Yeah, that was terrible. And then I think a little bit like Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale is certainly imagines a future fascism, but the fundamental mechanism is the control of natalism, right? It's control of women, control of reproduction, and that really kind of goes way back, right? So that's why I sort of threw it into the retrospective category.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and just to kind of add more breadth for the folks, there's a Philip K. Dick series on Amazon Prime that you can if you're a book reader, go get the book. It's a short read. Philip K. Dick wrote maybe like 120 page novels, something like that. But you can catch the movie too. I thought it was all right. A miniseries, but it didn't keep my interest to keep watching it. So, but that's just me. But it had some pretty cool scenes that I did enjoy, like when they were driving around in the car and there was like ash falling from the sky.
Yes.
And I don't remember reading about that in the book. I was like, what the hell is this about? And then it's about, you know, I believe they were burning bodies or something to that effect. Nice. So.
Yes, useless eaters. Right, not contributing to society. You know, that's a great scene, and it has an American police officer just commenting like, I don't even remember what we were fighting about as the ash rains down around him. Yes. Ooh, very disturbing. So then, you know, in the contemporary category, you can think of stories that are basically dealing with what was currently happening to people. So I like to use Dr. Strangelove as an example, because it is one of the funniest films ever made, even today. But it's also dealing humorously with the strange concept of Project Paperclip, which some people may recognize as the U.S.'s program to bring useful Germans into the United States to work in the military-industrial sector. And of course, the Soviets also took Germans, and there's for the same purpose. And there's a great line in the film when one of the characters says, our Germans are better than their Germans.
Right.
So yeah, there were some concerns in the 1960s about that. And then we had the old Star Trek episode, Taste of Armageddon, one of my favorites because it's a satire of the draft and the Vietnam War, where these two planets are at war with each other and they fight their war with computers. So there's no bombs, there's no explosions, there's no physical destruction to the society's infrastructure, but people get notices. If they're declared casualties, they have to walk into a disintegration booth, which I don't know how they got that past the censors, past the standards and practices people, because it was such an obvious parody of the draft, right, of conscription. It's one of my favorites.
Fascists, so delightful. I actually don't think fascists have good imagination, but that's probably not quite true. I think people who have jobs aren't going out of their way to think really hard and to solve censorship problems. At least that was my observation in China, is that my impression as someone who's lived in China 7 years is that the communist mechanisms are all lazy and they don't want to be bothered with. They just want to earn their pay, go home and watch TV or whatever, you know? So that whole like trickle down effect of not trying that hard to excel at something, it exists. It's a thing.
Oh, that's a great observation. Yeah, very likely the censors, I mean, if your job is censorship, right? I mean, how invested are you really in that job? I don't know. Mostly you're probably just afraid something will get through that you'll get canned for, right?
And that is a possibility. And then you could probably use your position for bribes as well. Growing up has never been easy, even in prehistoric Mesopotamia. Young Akia was the runt of a tribe that's legendary for feats of strength. But Akia prefers feats of intelligence. However, that gets him no respect from his peers. He gets into more trouble when he accidentally disrupts his tribe's corner on the market of hauling goods due to his invention of using levers. This idea becomes so popular that the neighboring tribes no longer require his own tribe's services. To make matters even worse, music television marketers from the future are meddling with the culture of the region. At first, Akia is excited by the strangers, but then realizes that there is a danger in becoming dependent on their gifts. But the strangers' pull is drawing the youth away from all of the tribes. So Akia must find a way to save his people Join the music television marketers with their technological magic, or join with his elders who had rejected him. Caveman Funk, a novelette by Lancer Kind, is available on Amazon Kindle. Check out the show notes, because we have got an amazing plethora of information that you will be interested in. We have visualizations of fascism over time. We have tables of how science fiction rates at different levels of fascism. And we have, of course, our very own United States of America rated there with a graph on the increasing levels of fascism. Next episode, more Jim Gallison.
So there's a parody character of the President of the United States named Ferris F. Fremont. And his the three letters FFF means 666, right? He's commenting on the immediate fascist concerns about, you know, Richard Nixon's policies. And interestingly, his followers, what we would call MAGA today, were called FAPPers, Friends of the American People, the FAP.